Daffy, like Dr. Henderson, is concerned with demonstrating, in the familiar fabric of the conscious, man's recurring interest in, almost obsession, with the symbols of the unconscious. They have for him a profoundly significant, almost a nourishing and sustaining inner attraction, whether they occur in the myths and fairy tales that Dr. Henderson analyzes, or in the visual arts, which, as Mrs. Jaffe shows, satisfy and delight us by a constant appeal to the unconscious. Finally, I must say a brief word about Dr. Jacobi's chapter, which is somewhat separate from the rest of the book. It is, in fact, an abbreviated case history of one interesting and successful analysis. The value of such a chapter in a book like this is obvious, but two words of warning are nevertheless necessary. First, as Dr. von Franz points out, there is no such thing as a typical Jungian analysis. There can't be, because every dream is a private and individual communication, and no two dreams use the symbols of the unconscious in the same way. So every Jungian analysis is unique, and it is misleading to consider this one, taken from Dr. Jacobi's clinical files, or any other one there has ever been, as representative or typical. All one can say of the case of Henry and his sometimes lurid dreams is that they form one true example of the way in which the Jungian method may be applied to a particular case. Secondly, the full history of even a comparatively uncomplicated case would take a whole book to recount. Inevitably, the story of Henry's analysis suffers a little in compression. The references, for instance, to the I Ching have been somewhat obscured and lent an unnatural and, to me, unsatisfactory flavor of the occult by being presented out of their full context. Nevertheless, we concluded, and I am sure the reader will agree, that with the warnings duly given, the clarity, to say nothing of the human interest, of Henry's analysis greatly enriches this book. I began by describing how Jung came to write Man and His Symbols. I end by reminding the reader of what a remarkable, perhaps unique publication this is. Carl Gustav Jung was one of the great doctors of all time, and one of the great thinkers of this century. His object always was to help men and women to know themselves, so that by self-knowledge and thoughtful self-use, they could lead full, rich, and happy lives. At the very end of his own life, which was as full, rich, and happy as any I have encountered, he decided to use the strength that was left him to address his message to a wider public than he had ever tried to reach before. He completed his task and his life in the same month. This book is his legacy to the broad reading public. Side 1, Tone 1, Contents. Side 1, Tone 2, Part 1, Approaching the Unconscious, by Carl G. Jung. Side 3, Tone 1, Part 2, Ancient Myths and Modern Man, by Joseph L. Henderson. Side 5, Tone 1, Part 3, The Process of Individuation, by M. L. von Franz. Side 7, Tone 1, Part 4, Symbolism in the Visual Arts, by Aniela Jaffe. Side 9, Tone 1, Part 5, Symbols in an Individual Analysis, by Yolanda Jacobi. Side 10, Tone 1, Conclusion, Science and the Unconscious, by M. L. von Franz. Narrator's Note. The 5 pages of reference notes found in the print edition are not included in this recording. Explanatory notes have been retained. End of note. Part 1, Approaching the Unconscious, by Carl G. Jung. The Importance of Dreams. Man uses the spoken or written word to express the meaning of what he wants to convey. His language is full of symbols, but he also often employs signs or images that are not strictly descriptive. Some are mere abbreviations or strings of initials, such as UN, UNICEF, or UNESCO. Others are familiar trademarks, the names of patent medicines, badges, or insignia. Although these are meaningless in themselves, they have acquired a recognizable meaning through common usage or deliberate intent. Such things are not symbols, They are signs, and they do no more than denote the object to which they are attached. What we call a symbol is a term, a name, or even a picture that may be familiar in daily life, yet that possesses specific connotations in addition to its conventional and obvious meaning. It implies something vague, unknown, or hidden from us. Many Cretan monuments, for instance, are marked with the design of the double adze. This is an object that we know, but we do not know its symbolic implications. For another example, take the case of the Indian who, after a visit to England, told his friends at home that the English worship animals because he had found eagles, lions, and oxen in old churches. He was not aware, nor are many Christians, that these animals are symbols of the evangelists and are derived from the vision of Ezekiel, and that this in turn has an analogy to the Egyptian sun god Horus and his four sons. There are, moreover, such objects as the wheel and the cross that are known all over the world, yet that have a symbolic significance under certain conditions. Precisely what they symbolize is still a matter for controversial speculation. Thus, a word or an image is symbolic when it implies something more than its obvious and immediate meaning. It has a wider unconscious aspect that is never precisely defined or fully explained, nor can one hope to define or explain it. As the mind explores the symbol, it is led to ideas that lie beyond the grasp of reason. The wheel may lead our thoughts toward the concept of a divine sun, but at this point reason must admit its incompetence. Man is unable to define a divine being. When, with all our intellectual limitations, we call something divine, we have merely given it a name, which may be based on a creed, but never on factual evidence. Because there are innumerable things beyond the range of human understanding, we constantly use symbolic terms to represent concepts that we cannot define or fully comprehend. This is one reason why all religions employ symbolic language or images. But this conscious use of symbols is only one aspect of a psychological fact of great importance. Man also produces symbols unconsciously and spontaneously in the form of dreams. It is not easy to grasp this point, but the point must be grasped if we are to know more about the ways in which the human mind works. Man, as we realize if we reflect for a moment, never perceives anything fully or comprehends anything completely. He can see, hear, touch, and taste, but how far he sees, how well he hears, what his touch tells him, and what he tastes, depend upon the number and quality of his senses. These limit his perception of the world around him. By using scientific instruments, he can partly compensate for the deficiencies of his senses. For example, he can extend the range of his vision by binoculars, or of his hearing, by electrical amplification. But the most elaborate apparatus cannot do more than bring distant or small objects within range of his eyes, or make faint sounds more audible. No matter what instrument he uses, at some point he reaches the edge of certainty, beyond which conscious knowledge cannot pass. There are, moreover, unconscious aspects of our perception of reality. The first is the fact that even when our senses react to real phenomena, sights and sounds, they are somehow translated from the realm of reality into that of the mind. Within the mind, they become psychic events whose ultimate nature is unknowable, for the psyche cannot know its own psychical substance. Thus, every experience contains an indefinite number of unknown factors, not to speak of the fact that every concrete object is always unknown in certain respects, because we cannot know the ultimate nature of matter itself. Then there are certain events of which we have not consciously taken note. They have remained, so to speak, below the threshold of consciousness. They have happened, but they have been absorbed subliminally, without our conscious knowledge. We can become aware of such happenings only in a moment of intuition or by a process of profound thought that leads to a later realization that they must have happened. And though we may have originally ignored their emotional and vital importance, it later wells up from the unconscious as a sort of afterthought. It may appear, for instance, in the form of a dream. As a general rule, the unconscious aspect of any event is revealed to us in dreams, where it appears not as a rational thought, but but as a symbolic image. As a matter of history, it was the study of dreams that first enabled psychologists to investigate the unconscious aspect of conscious psychic events. It is on such evidence that psychologists assume the existence of an unconscious psyche, though many scientists and philosophers deny its existence. They argue naively that such an assumption implies the existence of two subjects, or, to put it in a common phrase, two personalities within the same individual. But this is exactly what it does imply, quite correctly, and it is one of the curses of modern man that many people suffer from this divided personality. It is by no means a pathological symptom. It is a normal fact that can be observed at any time and everywhere. It is not merely the neurotic whose right hand does not know what the left hand is doing. This predicament is a symptom of a general unconsciousness that is the undeniable common inheritance of all mankind. Man has developed consciousness slowly and laboriously, in a process that took untold ages to reach the civilized state, which is arbitrarily dated from the invention of script in about 4000 BC. And this evolution is far from complete, for large areas of the human mind are still shrouded in darkness. What we call the psyche is by no means identical with our consciousness and its contents. Whoever denies the existence of the unconscious is in fact assuming that our present knowledge of the psyche is total, and this belief is clearly just as false as the assumption that we know all there is to be known about the natural universe. Our psyche is part of nature, and its enigma is as limitless. Thus we cannot define either the psyche or nature. We can merely state what we believe them to be, and describe as best we can how they function. Quite apart, therefore, from the evidence that medical research has accumulated, there are strong grounds of logic for rejecting statements like, "there is no unconscious." Those who say such things merely express an age-old misanthropism, a fear of the new and the unknown. There are historical reasons for this resistance to the idea of an unknown part of the human psyche. Consciousness is a very recent acquisition of nature, and it is still in an experimental state. It is frail, menaced by specific dangers, and easily injured. As anthropologists have noted, one of the most common mental derangements that occur among primitive people is what they call the loss of a soul, which means, as the name indicates, a noticeable disruption, or more technically, a dissociation of consciousness. Among such people, whose consciousness is at a different level of development from ours, the soul or psyche is not felt to be a unit. Many primitives assume that a man has a bush soul as well as his own, and that this bush soul is incarnate in a wild animal or a tree with which the human individual has some kind of psychic identity. This is what the distinguished French ethnologist Lucien Lévi-Brulle called a mystical participation. He later retracted this term under pressure of adverse criticism, but I believe that his critics were wrong. It is a well-known psychological fact that an individual may have such an unconscious identity with some other person or object. This identity takes a variety of forms among primitives. If the bush soul is that of an animal, the animal itself is considered as some sort of brother to the man. A man whose brother is a crocodile, for instance, is supposed to be safe when swimming a crocodile-infested river. If the bush soul is a tree, the tree is presumed to have something like parental authority over the individual concerned. In both cases, an injury to the bush soul is interpreted as an injury to the man. In some tribes, it is assumed that a man has a number of souls. This belief expresses the feeling of some primitive individuals that they each consist of several linked but distinct units. This means that the individual's psyche is far from being safely synthesized. On the contrary, it threatens to fragment only too easily under the onslaught of unchecked emotions. While this situation is familiar to us from the studies of anthropologists, it is not so irrelevant to our own advanced civilization as it might seem. We too can become dissociated and lose our identity. We can be possessed and altered by moods, or become unreasonable and unable to recall important facts about ourselves or others, so that people ask, "What the devil has got into you?" We talk about being able to control ourselves, but self-control is a rare and remarkable virtue. We may think we have ourselves under control, yet a friend can easily tell us things about ourselves of which we have no knowledge. Beyond doubt, even in what we call a high level of civilization, human consciousness has not yet achieved a reasonable degree of continuity. It is still vulnerable and liable to fragmentation. This capacity to isolate part of one's mind, indeed, is a valuable characteristic. It enables us to concentrate upon one thing at a time, excluding everything else that may claim our attention. But there is a world of difference between a conscious decision to split off and temporarily suppress a part of one's psyche, and a condition in which this happens spontaneously, without one's knowledge or consent, and even against one's intention. The former is a civilized achievement, the latter a primitive loss of a soul, or even the pathological cause of a neurosis. Thus, even in our day, the unity of consciousness is still a doubtful affair. It can too easily be disrupted. An ability to control one's emotions that may be very desirable from one point of view would be a questionable accomplishment from another, for it would deprive social intercourse of variety, color, and warmth. It is against this background that we must review the importance of dreams, those flimsy, evasive, unreliable, vague, and uncertain fantasies. To explain my point of view, I should like to describe how it developed over a period of years, and how I was led to conclude that dreams are the most frequent and universally accessible source for the investigation of man's symbolizing faculty. Sigmund Freud was the pioneer who first tried to explore empirically the unconscious background of consciousness. He worked on the general assumption that dreams are not a matter of chance, but are associated with conscious thoughts and problems. This assumption was not in the least arbitrary. It was based upon the conclusion of eminent neurologists, for instance, Pierre Janet, that neurotic symptoms are related to some conscious experience. They even appear to be split-off areas of the conscious mind, which at another time and under different conditions can be conscious. Before the beginning of this century, Freud and Josef Breuer had recognized that neurotic symptoms, hysteria, certain types of pain, and abnormal behavior, are in fact symbolically meaningful. They are one way in which the unconscious mind expresses itself, just as it may in dreams, and they are equally symbolic. A patient, for instance, who is confronted with an intolerable situation may develop a spasm whenever he tries to swallow. He can't swallow it. Under similar conditions of psychological stress, another patient has an attack of asthma. He can't breathe the atmosphere at home. A third suffers from a peculiar paralysis of the legs. He can't